Hey everybody, welcome to today's episode of No Killing Goblins. I'm Oshi, and I'm here with my co-host, Dragon Nuss.
Yo, yo, what everybody doing today?
We're recording on a weekday, so we usually record on a weekend, and I am not tired, I am jazzed. How about you?
Oh, I'm exhausted.
What? Why?
It's Monday.
It's just Monday, we have a whole week ahead of us. Maybe I'm just, like, recovered enough from the COVIDs to be happy about it.
I mean, that could be it. Usually my thought when I realize I have a whole week ahead of me is nowhere near as enthusiastic as you're being right now.
Well, I guess I'm just a little bit happier because I feel I've been not doing things for a while. And the best news ever, tomorrow or midnight or whenever, several of my favorite writers' books are coming out. Alona Andrews' new book, so many good things are coming out. I wanted to talk about it so much because, again, I may have forgotten to pick a book for us to chat about this week. So I'm just going to talk about books that are coming out.
Oh, well, I mean, I think technically it was my turn this week anyways, but if you want to talk about something that excites you, I can just take two next time.
What were you? Did you pick something?
No, but I just have a whole bunch of stuff I'm ready to talk about at all times.
Oh, pick something! Go!
No. If you're genuinely excited for something that's coming out like immediately, I'm wanting to talk about books that are like a decade old at this point.
No, that's look. All the books I want to talk about are mostly wrapped up in the writers I want to talk about, not so much the book.
Well, then talk about the writers then.
Oh. God damn it, Dragoness. We're going to have to cut all that out. Just say what you want to talk about.
Well, I'm... Fuck, now I... Okay, hold on. Give me a second to, like, recharge my brain. I was mostly just making a joke. You have stuff you're excited about. Talk about it, please.
Oh, I will. Just start... Oh, God. This is like... We're like an old couple arguing over a nickel we found on the street. Come on, dude. Alona Andrews, Patricia Briggs, Shauna McGuire's book is coming out on the 30th, but Jim C. Hines, a whole bunch of writers, all of whom were seriously affected by the pandemic or by their writing schedules or whatever, that haven't been writing in a while, that haven't really produced any work, all of them are publishing on the 23rd. On top of that, which is tomorrow, on top of that, there is a bunch of books that came out earlier this month. The Bruising of Kilwa, Kalyana the Soothsayer, all of which I have been dying to read. I am terrified about reading some of them because Be the Serpent, which is Shannon McGuire's book, is part of her long-running series. The October Day series, which is like... think Buffy crossed with Faye stuff. And it's just like episodic tales. And it's really nice. It's much better written than Buffy.
Is that the one where... Well, one, hold on. Those are fighting words. Two, is that the one where like you always talk with the Faye in Latin? Because since it's a dead language, meanings can't be twisted?
No.
Okay, there's something that I remember that was like urban fantasy, Buffy, but it dealt a lot with the Faye. And that was a rule in it. And I cannot remember what series it was.
So, Shauna McGuire... Okay, I guess I should go back and talk about Shauna McGuire first. Shauna McGuire is one of the most prolific writers, and she was, to me, Pirate ABBA before Pirate ABBA came around. Because she posted stories on her blog. She writes a prodigious amount. I honestly think if she wrote at the same pace, like, in the same way Pirate did, she could match Pirate. I'm not kidding. She writes up to 4 books, maybe 5 books a year, and this is through the editing process, the whole thing that needs to go through. So yeah, she writes a fucking lot, and she's really, really good. And when I say Buffy, I'm talking about the kind of quippy, fun experience that you get through with a lot of emotional trauma. I'm not talking about a lot of the misogyny and weird shit that goes on in Buffy's. But it's a very mature series. This is like 11th or 12th book. It's been around forever. It started off very much like a Pirate ABBA special where the first book, the character was like miserable, and you were miserable with her, and you kind of didn't like her. But as the series evolves, you begin to love her, you begin to love the people that she's with. And the setting is all, a lot of people don't, I've had people straight up say, I don't like this because it has to do with the Fae. Sure, whatever. The main character is a changeling. She is Fae. She was born in Faerie, and it's not what you think. It's very hard to describe because the setting is so well done. Seanan pulled very well from like both mythology and the truth of everything. So the Fae are this big giant family, and they've been banished from Faerie by their parents when one of the three big people, Titania, Maeve, and Oberon, were the three big people, the progenitors of their race, their gods, quote unquote. One of them died, we think, and the other two like sealed up Faerie and told their kids to go live out in the world because we gotta go somewhere. And there's this whole mystery result, a meta mystery around that, and the main character is Octave Bridé, a kid who was born in Faerie, a changeling, and changelings are people who are half human, half fairy, and they get a really rough ride because the people in Faerie kind of tend to treat them as like dogs, pets. They're terribly treated, and she grows up in a nice place, but. And then eventually finds herself in a horrible position. She has to go through all the terror of being a changeling. And she grows up and becomes the Knight of Lost Words. And she was living in the late 90s, early 80s, I don't remember. And she had a little kid. She married a human. She was being the Knight of Lost Words. And she was doing all the nice things. And then one day, she comes up against someone who's way more powerful than her, turns her into a fish, and she spends the next 16 years, 17 years in a pond as a fish, and she comes back, and that's the start of the series. It's epic to me and very special to me, and there's such a huge revelation coming in the next book, and I cannot wait for it, and I'm literally frothing at the mouth.
That,
And then there,
let's say,
go ahead.
that does sound interesting. It kind of puts me in mind, actually, more of Dresden Files than Buffy.
I mean, she's the contemporary of Dresden Files. Her books came out roughly around the same period when urban fantasy was big, and Alona Andrews, Patricia Briggs, Laurel K. Hamilton, Jim Butcher—they were the big people who wrote urban fantasy. And God, Seanan is so good at writing the episodic content, so every book feels like an episode, and every four books feels like a season, and it's just so well done. She's a really good comic book writer too. She writes a lot of comic book stuff,
That
but
might,
I'm
I
excited.
say, her
Go
name
ahead.
sounds familiar, and it's either because she's been kicking around urban fantasy for so long, and I've probably been recommended her a billion times and never gotten to it, or because comic book stuff. Hold on, comic book
Because
stuff. Hold on, I need to Google something because I think I know where I know her from. Oh yeah, she did the amazing Nightcrawler stuff.
okay, yes. There is a lot that comes
Oh,
with,
and
like,
Spider-Gwen. Okay. Oh, she's doing. Okay, yeah, I've read most of her comic books. I just don't often pay attention to who's writing comic books.
She's an amazing writer. I love her. The other big book that's coming out is, well, actually two books that are coming out that are ending series, or at least temporary ending series, is Alona Andrews' new Hidden Legacy book and Jim C. Hines' Janitors of the Apocalypse series, which is Ruby something. God, I'm having that moment where I can't remember names again. Ruby Fever and Jim C. Hines' Janitors of the Apocalypse is Terminal Peace. That's the one. So they're very different, but they're by, but they have a theme, like the writers have a similar thematic thing. I like writers who use humor, a lot of pathos, and do big rollicking adventures. So Ruby Fever is by Alona Andrews in their Hidden Legacy world, and in this universe, it's very romance heavy. It's a It's about romance. It is a romance. And Ruby Fever is the end of the second series in this world. And in this world, around the 1800s, people figured out a way to genetically modify everybody to have normal human beings to have magic. And that's the divergent point in this alternate history world. And eventually, the magically capable people had descendants, and they developed a sort of alternate world where the magical people like made noble houses, think the Medicis and like the Italian houses in the Renaissance. But in modern era, they're rich, they're powerful, they have magic, and it's all about magic. And if you have magic, you get power, but on the flip side, you're also part of a sociopathic, kill or be killed kind of environment where people can die in a ballroom and nobody is shocked, they just leave as if it was nothing. And into this world is thrust this little family of PIs, and this series is all about the family, their hidden legacy, and what it means, and how they interact with the world, and how they reckon with that legacy and the world that it develops around it. I'm not going to say anything more than that because, you know what? Go read it if you want. I love the series. I love the premise. It is very well done. And Alona Andrews is hilarious. They do a great job developing a family around it. The characters are all vibrant and humorous. There's literally a book where one of the mages is an animal mage. And there is so many cute scenes. Oh my God, that involves like pets because the authors themselves have a lot of pets and they're very animal friendly. So it's just there's so much nice things and then also cool things like, you know, the destruction of an entire city block by somebody, massive flame storms, ripping tornadoes, explosions. If you can't tell, I like blood, guts, humor, and comedy. And no, I'm not a Marvel fan.
I mean, Marvel's fine. I'm confused. Where'd that come from?
Because, no, that comes from the fact that every time I say that, they immediately go, oh, have you watched Marvel movies? The Marvel movies don't have sex in it. And that's why I don't love them. There's no, everybody's chaste. It's
At
fine.
the risk of spoiling the single best punchline from the otherwise pretty okay She-Hulk TV show. Captain America fucks.
I saw that shit on Twitter.
I'm just I that punchline was so good it almost gave me third degree burns. I was cooking congee and I was laughing so hard I flailed my arm and almost flipped like an entire pot of boiling rice onto me.
The other book in Terminal Peace is part of The Janitors of the Apocalypse. And it's by Jim Cyhines, who wrote one of my favorite series ever, Jig the Goblin. And he writes these very quirky, well-written stories that have a lot of like, tragedy inherent in them. Again, theme. But he wrote this one, and it's about the far future where most of Earth's population has been wiped out by this disease that was brought by an alien race. And the survivors are these souped-up zombie-like beings who were saved by a group of other aliens who decided maybe humanity shouldn't be wiped out by a disease that we accidentally gave them. And and they come out of it and the main characters are basically custodians on a ship. And their crew gets wiped out, they have to take over the ship, and then they unravel all of the myth like the truths of how Earth got infected by the zombie apocalypse that turned them into like super soldiers and all this, and they save people, and it happens, and the series is ending, and it's a lot of like really funny jokes about janitorial services and explosions and space. It's a very space opera. I love it. It's great.
Well, I do like me a spice opera.
you would like this actually the Jim C. Hines book you would like
I mean, all of them sound like
it's
they're
not
up my alley. I'll admit I can sometimes get fae fatigue, but that's what just reading one book in a series at a time is for, not trying to binge the whole thing in 15 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I have. Here's the thing about Shonen's portrayal of the Fae. I have never seen someone who genuinely took the time to develop a society without like leaning into the oh mysterious devilish. No, she writes the Fae as if they're very much people. People with motivations, families, sisters, cousins, they hate each other, they love each other, it feels less like divine beings or outsiders and more like just a reflection of humans. Like there is a character in Shannon's book, and he is half like a mer person and half like a normal land fae, and there's this big divide for him between staying with his family under the sea and or he sorry because he cannot stay with his family under the sea. He needs to find his place elsewhere. He can't survive in it because it's a very violent place. He just doesn't have the magic or ability to survive it. He loves his family, but he can't stay with them. And he ends up taking over a little seaside community and becoming the noble for them. And it's like a minor character, but there is so much depth given to that minor character. And there's so much motivation, so much love between the character, the family, the persons that interact with them. I'm trying very hard to avoid spoilers, so
Yeah,
it's hard to
it
like.
puts me in mind actually of like, good xenofiction.
Yes, it could definitely be like that. I've talked for a long time, so fill some space, Dragonus, before I feel bad.
Oh, well, I like I said, I've definitely written down two of those three to check out. It was the right Jim C. Hine, right? HEIN.
Jim C. HEINES. Hines.
HEINZS.
Z
C.
C.
Charlie
Hines.
S. Charlie
Sorry.
Sierra.
Hines. HINES. Sorry.
All right, so I had it right the first time. All right, yeah, I will definitely check that out. And oh God, what else was I just thinking about? Like I said, both of those do seem interesting.
I love all three of those writers. Ilona Andrews is a writing duo, so technically it's four writers, because they write interesting scenes. They try to find the interesting like combinations of weird stuff, and then they ground all of that weird stuff in the most familial human aspects of who you are as a person, right? It's not about the plot, it's about the person, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, what kind of books were you going to talk about?
Oh, well, I had in mind just, a few books to talk about, mostly because I think they're really good, written by a couple of my favorite authors, but also stuff that, like, nobody ever talks about. And the one that I had in mind today. It's the first one in a three-part series. It's called The Last Stormlord. Now, I'm just going to drop a content warning here that I will then go back and later add in when we'll stop talking about it. But not so much for like talking about the book, but if you're going to read any of these books, understand this content warning is for yes. It's a great series, but it takes place in a very harsh world. And if you don't like bugs, they ride giant centipedes, and their equivalent of guns is pointing giant murder beetles at you that fly at you and pull a Brennan Fraser mummy, only, less kind of goofy. The setting is a desert where it does not naturally rain unless wizards with water powers make it. And there is a lot of descriptions of the harsh reality of trying to survive and maintain a society with an ever-dwindling water supply because these wizards are being born less and less often. There's interesting magic, really fascinating, well-thought-out characters. Probably one of my all-time favorite trans characters shows up in the third book, but any more context than that would be a like really severe spoiler. People die horribly and brutally, men, women, children, infants. Like, It is a great story. It's by Glenda Lark, who is just an author I wish would get talked about more. She's an Australian writer who has been writing for a long, long, long time. This is probably my favorite series by her.
Lark with an E,
Yeah.
right?
But everything she's written has been pretty good. And God, so it the first book like does a lot of setting sort of the plot, and it's re about, you know, a young boy who in this search for people who are powerful enough to desalinate water out of the ocean and bring enough of it over to keep multiple cities alive and breathing. He, you know, people find out he can do this, and it's really not a fun experience for him or anyone nearby him at the time. And things escalate from there, and it also on the side follows the story of an entirely different concept of water-based power that is, as far as I know, pretty much unique to this series, wherein there's people who can paint a picture. They paint it on water using a special blend of powders, and then what they depict will happen. It just will.
Yeah, okay. I'm like absorbing. Normally there'd be a head nod right here.
Yeah.
So Glenda Lark is she's I'm reading about a little bit. She's a I was wondering why I haven't heard of her. Because she's an Australian writer, I probably haven't been exposed to her so much.
Yeah,
Which makes sense.
which makes sense, but
It's
is a terrible shame.
yeah, it is it's harder for me to even in the English language world, it's hard to reach out to writers from other countries. If you were a writer pre like 2010 or so, because the globalization of like writers and their social media presences didn't happen until I'd say after 2010, after 2012 even. And nowadays you can there are so many gems, so many people who are wonderful writers. I proselytize about Tanya Huff and Lois McMaster-Gerold and Tamora Pierce all the time, and they're American writers. Like, or well, actually, Tanya Huff is Canadian. And it's just, yeah, it's hard to get that out. But I think that sounds like a really good book, and I will add it to my list, which is getting longer
And
every day.
longer and
Ugh.
longer. And you're right, it can just be hard to find these people. The only reason I found this series is because for a long while I basically lived inside of Books a Million because it was hot outside and I could read books for free. And
Oh
back when
God.
that place was a real place, it was a good time. I half the time feel like maybe I put them out of business with the amount of times I treated them like a stand-in library, but it was either that or sit in a hot car. God, now I miss books. I just miss bookstores in general. Like,
Here's my problem with bookstores. I miss libraries, not bookstores. At least New York City public libraries. I frequented them so much. There was it was hard getting. Okay, I have a weird story to tell about it, but I'll tell it off recording device. But New York City public libraries always felt more comfortable to me than going into a Barnes and Nobles or a Waterstones. Before they were broken down and all that. Like the bookstores, it felt weird. The only place like to sit and read, even places like the Strand, which is super famous all over the fucking place, it just never felt as good as like going into a public library and sitting in a corner and just reading. Because not only would no one bother you, they want you to do that. And even if you only got to stay there till 5 because the library's hours got cut because nobody has money for it. You still felt, I don't know, it felt nice.
Yeah, I get what you mean. We don't have, you know, quite as big libraries like that out in like the rural places where I grew up. Although there is one down in Maryville that I really like. It's huge, just fucking huge. Like the kind of place you can wander in and get lost in.
Speaking of getting lost, though,
We appear to have gotten
today.
lost on our way to the chapter.
No, we haven't because but Aaron gets lost in today's pair of chapters, chapter 2.43 and 2.44. Aaron goes on a little trip, not willingly, but she does. We're starting with 242. Sorry, not 2.43, 2.42 and 2.43. Anyway, so Aaron, the first chapter, the start of 242, is doing good business. She manages to sell some good money stuff to a bunch of people, and then things chill out. I like the start of this chapter because there's a moment, a couple of moments that kind of stick out. The first one being, remember, do you remember, I don't know if it stuck up to you, but Leonette laughed, like genuinely laughed when Mersha licked her hand.
Yeah, you can see that, like, she's growing into her position there. She's beginning to feel more comfortable, mostly because of Mersha, because adorable children that are also adorable puppies probably just have an immense amount of power to, what's the phrase? Defrost the soul.
No, it's they get behind barriers. As human beings, I don't know what it may you as you grow up, you learn to create a sort of hard outer shell around yourself, a kind of emotional barrier to protect yourself from the con like life. Life beats at you, the world beats at you, and you have to start to survive that. You have to learn to manage all of the both negative and positive emotions to a level that lets you deal with life. And people put up walls often. And children are the few, I think, for most emotionally stable and even unstable folks, people who can sort of get past those barriers because they don't have an expectation of the world. They're still learning, they're still figuring shit out. And for them, they take everyone as they are. There's still wonder in their eyes. There's no expectation of disappointment or anything like that. And the whole Leonette part kind of ended on a line that I found was the biggest moment for me to like aha moment when at the end of her passage it goes, but it was better than being useless.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it that was, I'm not gonna call it like, oh, it broke the universe. It was perfect. Pirate is such an amazing art. No, but Pirate effectively used that singular line to convey so much, right?
Yeah.
You know who, yeah, go ahead.
It's fascinating the way that you just kind of get this one clear look into what really genuinely is motivating her, why she's out doing this, and why, I think it was in the last chapter or the one before where she mentions offhand that as much as she hates getting levels in Barmaid, at least she's getting levels.
Yeah.
And that makes you wonder exactly just how useful, how what level princess even is she?
What the hell was she doing that she feels so useless?
Meanwhile, Erin is busy revolutionizing her business by going, "Wait, Antinia meet bugs." And
Or at least
if
bees.
they want bees, then by God, Aaron will cook them bees on the special, frying pan set aside explicitly for that purpose and nothing else.
And she doesn't. She goes out, she whips Torin into shape. Torin hates her for putting Torin through all of the shit that Eren does to get her stuff. The whole slay situation. Torin is pissed. And even serving people, Torin is pissed. But before we dig too much into how pissed Torin is and what Eren does, there is another. Ryoka shows up this chapter too.
Yep, her and
And.
Kilmakich continue to do more plotting and planning and conspiracy theorying about how to, do leveling things, because levels
Yeah, and they
are
do.
apparently weird. And as much as he digs into it, Kilmakich can't find anything to contradict her level 100 theory.
It isn't perfect, but it is substantiated that leveling in singular classes is faster and better, and that focused people are better. It and what is interesting to me about what Ryoka does is she actively shares information with Kill the Kitch, and Kill the Kitch shares back. This and it's kind of sad that Kill the Kitch is not a good information source because they don't know much about the world. But I think I wonder just how much more Kill the Kitch gained from it than Ryoka did. I think Ryoka underestimates just how, like, she doesn't recognize or understand just how limited the Antinium's experience with the world is and why Eren is so important. And those moments that she spends with Kill the Kitch, I've always wondered why the two of them weren't like. Actually, no, I shouldn't even answer that. It's like she's too paranoid and he's too paranoid. But I kind of wondered if they would be good friends. If they should be good friends.
I think that Kill the Kitch might not quite grasp what friendship is, and even then, I still think he might be better at it than Ryoka. So I don't think the two of them would make good friends at all, not without like a great deal more time to
Maybe
work their
allies.
shit out. They do make great allies though, because they're both similarly paranoid, driven, and just willing enough to put themselves out there to trade this information because of Eren. It's like I said, she's trading a lot on goodwill Eren has developed, but she's trading well for it. And we actually got a really interesting bit of information out of this involving the nature of levels and classes and class consolidation.
Yeah, we do. It's a good way to like introduce us to a lot of the concepts that we're not, especially if you're not super familiar with like lit
And
RPG systems,
well,
right?
even outside of lit RPG systems, it reminds me a lot of prestige classes in D&D back before they took them out for I think they took them out for fourth. I know they're out in fifth. Where you would have a class that was meant to bridge the gap between two or more other classes and create something coherent out of them and let you sort of build into it to create something unique.
Excuse me. So the other part of the meat of the chapter, I guess, is that Eren goes off to collect bees. No, actually no, this isn't it. That's the next chapter. Whoops. Oh God, I've confused the two. I've conflated the two. I've mixed up the two.
Oh no, how dare you conflate two chapters that happened right next to each other?
But that's she does Ryoka does speak to Kershaya about dealing with about using this information as a sort of payback for all of the damage that Leonette did and to try to bring balance to that sort of debt. And Kershaya disappointingly has to tell her that it doesn't. It's great. It's big news. People could use it, but it's one of those slow things, and it's not worth the same as the like level of effort that the tribe put into collecting all those spell books.
Yeah,
And it's a
and it makes sense too, because that's the kind of information that can be really valuable for min-maxing. Unfortunately, we're talking about people, and sometimes people like we have like unflattering and unkind descriptors for the kind of parents who try and turn their children into miniature versions of themselves to live out the lives they didn't get to lead and go win that sports ball and get that acting trophy. And I can only imagine how much worse it would be if those people knew they could be rewarded for it by the leveling system.
I mean, speaking of all that, a little tiny bit of spoilers, we do get to see some versions of that in the
We
future.
do.
We literally got to see one.
I think I've missed it.
Right this
Did
chapter.
we?
The princess. You're only allowed to level as. Okay, cut this part out. You're only allowed to level as a princess? That's Leonette.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It wasn't mentioned in this chapter, so I was like
It
confused what you
doesn't.
were talking about.
It's one of the basic connections that I made. What you just, like? Why have Leonette at the start if you're not if you're gonna mention that? That was a thematic connection. I feel like I'm not. Am I the only one who does?
Like I think that like what I'm talking about and what goes on with like royalty is maybe not the same thing, but that's neither here nor there.
I mean, it's not just like that's what happens to anyone in a prestige position. Somebody who's a powerful merchant, somebody who's a powerful farm. There's lots of people who will insist on singular classes and certain levels of development,
It
but you're
does
literally.
not appear to be that common from what we've seen.
We have never actually seen the social structures. Okay, we should stop talking about this because it's all
Yeah,
spoiler
it's
stuff
all
anyway.
spoilers, and also I feel like you're making a lot of suppositions that don't fit the material.
We'll get into it some other time. So the next, I don't have anything to say about the author note. Did you read it?
I did. It was a pirate author note. Pirate author notes tend to have sort of the same tone to them a lot of the time, and I hate to try and put it like this, but pirate tired, pirate feel like they're doing good, pirate writing more next time, they promise.
Woo! And moving forward, so 2.43. 2.43 is like a big deal because a couple of things happened. One is that Erin and her bug Pan go off to collect more bees, and then she gets tired,
Yeah.
I
Well, so
guess. I, that's.
Aaron grabs Torin so that Torin can go on another magical journey carrying the sled with its jingling bells and Aaron singing, and everything is fine and nothing is strange, and Torin is ready to start screaming, yet he has no voice with which to do it. So instead, he carries Erin off into the middle of bloody nowhere and leaves her there, hoping she'll die and free him.
And doesn't work out quite the way he wants it to because she wakes up, starts singing a weird song, meets somebody with who's hard of hearing, and ends up in the city of
She
Selim.
doesn't meet someone who's hard of hearing. She makes someone hard of hearing.
Oh, that might be
She
it.
uses her loud voice skill because, well, she can punch wolves. It's easier just to scare them away. And then they go what at each other a bunch. I imagine it's very funny. I think there was a bear at some point. And eventually, Erin finds out where she's wound up. Interesting note,
And
though,
she.
that I noticed here is when the guy is like, "What on earth is that?" or "What in the name of God is that?" He says, "What in the name of dragons is that sound?" Which I think we might have heard before, but feels way more Drake or Lescorian than something I would expect from a human up north.
Well, Selim's re reasonably close to Lescor,
Reasonably,
so
but
they're.
even then, there's not what I would call a significant amount of cultural crossover between them.
I would say the opposite because just because it's regional, like Afro is regional sayings kind of cross over. You're not going to get an ancestors from the humans, but you might get stuff like dragons or Kraken's pass or some bullshit that passes from one trader to another.
Maybe,
It's not like you,
but there
yeah.
doesn't feel like a significant amount of trade. Like, they were surprised when Aaron showed up because they knew so little about the place, they didn't realize a human might live down there.
Well, yeah, that she's living there. That's not the same thing as like merchants traveling to a place, dropping shit off, and then disappearing back up north or whatever. It's not the same. That's what I'm trying to say. Like, things cross over. That's all I was. Adventurers cross over, folks cross over. It happens. Runners go from place to place. Things happen like that. Even like, remember, Magnolia sent a servant to Lescor. Like, shit like that happens all the time. And language crosses over. People make friends. It's impossible
It
for them not
still
to.
feels a little out of place, is all.
Okay, so Fuzzy Lips, who we find out the
Well,
name for
before
later,
we get
it.
to Fuzzy Lips, we have the goblins.
Oh yeah, I guess we should mention
Yeah,
that.
13 goblins. Each one dropped off, each one particularly capable over level 10 in their combat-oriented classes, all wearing armor that is of high quality, relatively speaking, and all are red fangs. They're on a mission to kill an innkeeper as soon as they find her.
Because they're lost. In any case, yeah. So Erin makes it to the gates of Selim. She gets stopped by a guard with fuzzy lips, and she gets charged some import taxes for her bees, makes it into the city. Some people try to mug her, and she beats the shit out of them, and then decides not to charge the little kid that was with them because he's gonna get lashed. I am repeating what happens in the chapter, but this is important because this is Erin Solstice's introduction
Yeah,
to. Yeah.
this chapter is all about sort of giving us the new setup and status quo. We get introduced to Fuzzy Lips, to Rev. We get to meet Octavia the Alchemist. All of these sort of characters we meet, they get names. We get to know more about the place. We're kind of getting our
And
new
you get.
status quo for Erin as she's been just completely removed from the comfortable place she's created over the past two books.
And it's very much an intro chapter, but I just love the way Erin interacts with the city. The city tries to like diminish her, punch her. First, they try to charge her a bunch of taxes. She's like, "Oh, I got a lot of money." Then they try to mug her, or at least the city tries to mug her, and she fights the city back. What the fuck? And then she heads off to the alchemist, and the alchemist is again surprised. Like everything is Erin surprising the city. While she's also surprised by the kind of attitude that the humans, who she hasn't been around a lot, and she's really appreciative of that she gets to be around humans a lot, are like. And she gets introduced to a Stitch person for the first time ever.
Yeah,
Like, that was
this
cool.
is the first time Erin has crossed over into Ryoka's sphere of the world, which is really cool. And Octavia is great. I'm amazed that we
Right.
didn't get more hustle from her, but at the same time, I mean, arguing with Erin is hard.
I'm just gonna say this right now because I messed up the chapters. It's 43, 44. We were mixing up events. You know what, guys? Just bear with us. The two chapters we're talking about it, they go together. Anyway, it just ends on a really nice, like, the pair of chapters work out really well. They transition Erin away, they introduce new conflict in the goblins and in Selim, and just do such a good job of just being interesting without like fucking with us too much, right?
Yeah.
Hello?
Sorry, I was just trying to think of what to
Yeah.
say next.
I don't know what to say next because that's it really is very short, very quick chapters. And they do a lot of like epic things, but it's more event-filled than it is introspective or thought-provoking, right?
Yeah. And a lot of this feels like Pirate was saying to themselves, I have established the setting, my main character is comfortable, we have a solid status quo forming. How do I kick it over?
Yeah,
And
exactly.
it feels like this was something that Pirate had definitely had planned though, right? This wasn't spur of the moment, because we had been building up to Torin and Torin's breaking point being the bells and just dealing with Lionette, which you know what? I can for once emphasize with the psychotic murderous skeleton that kills two innocent people. She can be a lot to deal with.
Right.
We knew that this was like something that was going to happen, but we didn't know this is what he was going to do when he did it. It's interesting that Erin gets brought conveniently to the place where Ryoka has sort of been basing herself, and now we can get some crossover where Ryoka has been in her place. Now she's in Ryoka's place, like Ryoka's zone, Ryoka's area, where presumably she'll make a bunch of friends and be more popular than Ryoka by the time Ryoka finds her.
So, that covers the two chapters much faster than I expected. Honestly, the biggest news is the introduction of Octavia, but I want to save discussing Octavia for a chapter where she's like a little bit more, spoiler alert, she comes around a few more times. So when we get to like deep dive a little bit more into her, I guess this is gonna be a short episode. Way shorter than I expected. We're at 45 minutes. Do we fill time or do we just end it?
Honestly, this feels like a good stopping point.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody. Email us, talk to us, tell us about books that you want us to talk about. And next week, I will actually have a book I want to talk about. I really want to talk about Lois McMaster-Bujold. Either her or Tamora Pierce. I haven't decided yet. And I really, really want to discuss everything to do with the writer and why I think LMB is one of the most underappreciated yet amazing writers that has ever come out of that period of time, and people should definitely be reading her books. Okay. You all good,
Yeah, I
Travis?
think I'm good.
All right. Bye,
Bye,
everybody.
everybody.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins.
Edited by Liquid Ender.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.